Hello, Gallatin Valley and online listeners. You're listening to KGVM, Bozeman Community Radio, broadcasting at 95.9 FM and streaming at kgvm.org. I'm Roxana, and this is Desert Oracle Radio Replay. I'm going to be traveling south this week, and I hope to see that full moon, some call it the worm moon, in all its lunar eclipse glory. But by the time you hear this, I hope you got to see it too. Since I will be gone the weekend of this show, I'm recording it early. Our first half hour, we have a Desert Oracle Radio episode created by Ken Lane on March 13th, 2020. His words from back then, inspired by the quarantine, have a familiar ring to them these days, though the same sort of grim inspiration today has a different name. See what you think. Here is The Invisible Friend.
Transmitting from the Mojave Wilderness in Joshua Tree, California, now is the time for Desert Oracle Radio, the voice of the desert.
Night has fallen on the desert, and it's been a real moody week out here. Dark clouds and blasts of cold rain. Thunder and lightning. It just feels like something's going on. Somewhere. Everywhere. The Invisible Friend. The invisible friend never sleeps. It doesn't know how. The invisible friend has come a-knockin'. So now what do we do? Well, we know, we sort of know what to do, some of us anyway. Those of us who have little will do little harm. For many who are first will become last. What is expected of us in this time? Some will never know what hit them. And some will go down swinging. Some will be all right, even though they made everything worse. Some will be called, during this time, these tribulations, called for various and mysterious reasons. Although we are weeping, in time we will smile. Let me share something with you, as we used to say down at the church on Sundays until they told us we couldn't hold hands or speak in tongues or actually go to church anymore. Not that many people went to church at all these past decades. I haven't been myself, and, well, do funerals count? Nobody really has funerals anymore. Can't afford them. And few will have them in the near future. They are ceremonies, after all. And the only ceremonies allowed at the moment are those of the heart. The work of the magician, the philosopher, the hermit, night work. Let me tell you what this one character said. This one character who lived in a desert land, contemplating the scum and villainy of his wretched era. Where are thy gods that thou hast made thee? Let them arise, if they can save thee in the time of thy trouble. For according to the number of thy cities are thy gods, O Judah. Wherefore will ye plead with me? Ye all have transgressed against me, saith the Lord. In vain have I smitten your children, they receive no correction. Your own sword hath devoured your prophets like a destroying lion. O generation, see ye the word of the Lord? Have I been a wilderness unto Israel, a land of darkness? Wherefore say my people, we are lords, we will come no more unto thee? Can a maid forget her ornaments, or a bride her attire? Yet my people have forgotten me days without number. Yet thou sayest, because I am innocent, surely his anger shall turn away from me. Behold, I will plead with thee, because thou sayest, I have not sinned. Jeremiah. From Jeremiah 2. That's in the Bible. The Bible, or Ta Biblia, as it was already called in Greek in the 3rd century. Book. Name for the town famous for its publishing industry going back 5,000 years, the Phoenician city of Byblos. And today's Lebanon. It's still there on Mount Lebanon, 26 miles up the coast from Beirut, which has also been around and continuously inhabited for at least 5,000 years. Now, Byblos has gone through a few name changes over the thousands of years, but Beirut has always been Beirut. Byblos made its name literally, in this case, from the import of Egyptian papyrus and the production of books. Early collections of the Gospels and the Epistles and Apocrypha were called Ta Biblia to Hagia, the Holy Books. The idea of a singular Bible would have to wait for another 14 centuries after the Reformation. If nobody was in charge of Christianity, then what was the authority? Who was the authority? I mean, here on earth. To Luther, it was his approved collection of Jewish and Christian holy books. Luther did not agree with some letters attributed to James and John, or the book of Hebrews. As for the revelation of St. John, Martin Luther did not like it at all. It was too crazy for his taste. Now, Martin Luther drank about 13 steins of beer every morning, but he did not care for LSD. So he said of the book of Revelation, "There's no Christ in it." The book of Revelation is, was like Chapo Trap House raging against the corrupt empire. You might have a little time on your hands these next weeks and months. Good time to acquaint yourself with the building blocks of our particular civilization while it's still here. Read the Shakespeare plays. Read them aloud if you can. Especially if you've got some willing participants already locked down with you. Read the Bible, the whole thing. It's a kick. Even those long lists of genealogy, who was begotten whom, etc. Great way to find some weird names for babies or dogs or whatever. The invisible friend. And if you're thinking, well, I don't even believe in that God or that devil, etc., all I can say is they believe in you. Especially the devil. Plus, the Bible is pretty much a million pages of various prophets and evangelists and hellraisers and bibliothumpers screeching and hollering because nobody believes in the right God, according to them. Everybody's off the path. The society, the kings, the priests. Just again and again. It took until medieval Europe for any sort of homogeneous following of Christianity, and as soon as that got settled by the sword, well, here comes Luther. They already had the Cathars and another 1,000 offshoots, and all of a sudden, there's no single religion again, and it's the Age of Reason, which is over now, by the way. Let's open up the mailbag and see what we got. I think I'm finally going to have the time to answer some more of these postcards and letters after I wipe them down with these Lysol baby wipes. Be careful where you use those things, by the way. Keep them above the belt. A lot of people have been contacting me lately asking if maybe they should pack up their bug-out bag and head for the desert. I say, I don't know, probably not. I mean, if everybody packs up and heads for the desert, we sort of know what happens. Las Vegas or Salt Lake or Phoenix and Tucson, the twin desert cities that have been growing together into one strange and enormous beast that will eventually be called something like AZ1 in the new times, the A-Zone where they drop the hard cases, the hardcore from cargo planes. One parachute for every 3 convicts. You all figure it out on the way down. Here's one from Carl Jung. Not that one. The one out in Joshua Tree. It's a real postcard. Despite Hume and the Buddha denying the existence of self, the latest musings seem pretty uniquely those of the voice of the desert. Carry on. Hope to catch you at the Ace on March 1 as my wave function becomes ever more peaked around JT. Well, thanks, Carl, and sorry about the cancellation on March 12 at the Ace. We got rained out. Honestly, it has been raining quite a lot out here, and I guess it's a good excuse to cancel without mentioning the invisible friend. Which I guess I've gone and done again anyway. Let's get another postcard. Here we go. From Zenko the Novice. And that must be my pal Jordan at Tassajara, the beautiful Zen monastery and retreat up there in the mountains over Big Sur and Carmel. I met Jordan and Lauren last year at a Campfire Stories down in Palm Springs at the Ace Hotel. They were on their honeymoon, a wild desert road trip, and now they're back at the monastery. Hey, did you know Emperor Ashoka sent Buddhist missionaries all over the ancient world? And that the similarities between the teachings of the Buddha and the teachings of Jesus are likely due to those missionaries having worked in Palestine? Anyway. We met you on Earth Day at the Ace, and I sent you a message from Death Valley during a spooky rain. Lauren and I are now married, have circumnavigated the globe, and are fast with child. Our little rat baby will arrive in early August, the peak of our deserty summers up here at Tassajara. I will be ordaining as a Zen priest this summer, meaning heavy-duty robes all through the heat. So the reason for this message, any advice for building a swamp cooler? Your pal, Zenko the Novice. Well, congratulations all around, first of all. And now the bad news. It might be a little too humid on the coast for swamp coolers to work the way they do out here in the desert. Now, I know you're up there in the mountains. I know it gets drier in the summer months. I've stayed there at Tassajara as a guest before. In fact, the last time I was there, it was either late July, early August, about 5 years back now, and it's pretty hot. And it's pretty humid. I did some checking of the humidity averages, and the closest I could find to you was down the mountain a bit in Jamesburg. And it looks like even on that drier eastern slope, you got nearly 60% humidity in August. Now, that's not New Orleans humidity, thank Christ, but it limits what an evaporative cooler can do. On days when the coastal moisture doesn't make it all the way up to your little valley up there in the mountains, you might appreciate the difference. But remember, what we're doing with a swamp cooler is evaporating a water supply over a pad of some kind. Historically, this was swamp moss, Spanish moss from Louisiana and East Texas. The lower the percentage of water vapor in the air, the more cooling you get from the evaporation of your water supply dribbling over the cooler pads. At 50% humidity, you can get a 10% decrease in the temperature. So if it's 90 degrees out, maybe you get it down to 80 Fahrenheit, which is going to make a difference when it's hot as hell and you're, for example, pregnant or wearing heavy monk robes or both. So don't expect an Arctic blast. Don't expect what you're going to get from a swamp cooler in the desert when there's 15% humidity. The cheapest and easiest way to make a swamp cooler is to get a trash bucket, an evil old plastic 20-liter model or similar is the least hassle. You'll keep it forever, so don't feel guilty about everything. Then you need some good utility shears, strong scissors, or a little saw or whatever. And if your quarters are anything like the beautiful little wooden cabins I've stayed at up there, you don't have much in the way of electricity. So get a battery-operated fan, like one of those USB-powered desktop fans. Maybe you need a little battery pack for it. Solar rechargeable would be handy up there. Just leave it in the window facing the sun, and you probably already have that stuff because you live up there. So now you cut some portholes in the trash can midway and put some kind of padding over those holes on the inside, something that can absorb water without collapsing, but that's still porous enough for the air to blow out. Hardware stores will have some loose swamp cooler pads, but other stuff will work. You can find a lot of internet tutorials with a range of options. But basically, you want to set the fan in a hole on the lid, airflow pointing down. Put some cold water in the bottom of the trash can and blow that hot room air down into the tub. The wet pads over the portholes will cool that air as the water evaporates and as your air blows out into the room. You shouldn't have to fill the water more than every day or so, but if the pads are dry, it's not going to cool, so make sure those pads are wet and absorbent. Then just point those portholes at you and enjoy the cool breeze. And to answer an earlier note from you that I sadly failed to answer with the old pen and postcard routine, I would love to come up and visit and work for my supper, provide some amusement, whatever. We'll talk once the plague passes and the sun comes out again. One more postcard, this one from Sarah. Sadly, I cannot read your last name here, but it looks like it starts with a T. Dear Desert Oracle, I do love your show as well as your publications. Thanks, I work with desert tortoises in the Mojave and appreciate the tidbits of knowledge you share regarding the desert tortoise. Accurate and informative. You briefly mentioned the farm once, speaking of colts, animals, etc. My uncle started the farm, Stephen Gaskin. Complicated things, communes. He was always a great uncle to me. I spend thousands of hours in the desert and have yet to see anything too weird other than the general public, but I do try to look up occasionally. Keep up the good work, Sarah. Well, thank you for that, Sarah, and thanks for helping out our tortoise friends. Boy, that's something about your uncle. The farm in Tennessee is a fascinating place. Stephen Gaskin and about 300 friends headed out from the Haight-Ashbury back in 1971. They wound up settling on some beautiful woodland and farmland in Tennessee, 1971. Is still there, one of the earliest intentional communities. I've read some interesting stuff on Gaskin and the farm. I mean, they did it. They went out and did it. Intentional communities are having a big comeback lately, and with good reason, as civil society breaks down, federal government collapses here in the United States, and all that. Wouldn't it be good to live amongst friends and neighbors in a community, doing interesting work, being outside much of the time in the fresh air? I think about this stuff a lot. All the time. We're gonna work it out. Patient brothers and sisters at Mariposa Landing. Forgive my delay in writing. I have quit the cabin at Alora. I was finally noticed there, and I probably stayed too long. They wanted to see what was on my desk and my bookshelf. They upended everything but found nothing of interest to them. But it was the signal to move on, and I managed to slip away into the desert. So let me return to a happier tale. The settlement at Yarrow. That spring flew by with all of us delighted in the work and especially delighted by the place we were creating. I had thought there was nothing uglier, nothing less humane than the ghastly stucco housing developments at the farthest edge of the great western cities. They sat out there divorced from town and nature both, connected by new roads to new concrete clusters of supermarkets and electronics stores with plastic lighted signs over the entrances as the only decoration. For 20 or 30 years, they continued to grow outward, propelled by a mysterious momentum until it all suddenly stopped. Until it all stopped and the people realized the momentum had been not only the cause, but the entire purpose. And yet here upon the skeleton of a charmless housing tract abandoned after the collapse, we had built a place of community that was open to the sky and the stars and the desert foothills. The largest structure, a gargantuan obscenity that could have sheltered 50 people but was designed for perhaps 4, was designated as the common house. As in all the unfinished houses, we had roofed over this one's exposed 2x4 rafters with sheets of green corrugated metal liberated from outside a scrapyard in Victorville. This gave the little village the cheerful look of a forest camp for school children and was so pleasing to the eye because it was so very different from the concrete red tile that adorned everything in California from fast food restaurants to mental health clinics. Inside the common house, all windows and glass patio doors had been left uncovered, leaving the big rooms not only filled with sunlight, but filled with the view of the mountains rising up to the south. With its sparse furnishings and clean concrete floors and makeshift copper bells in the huge kitchen where we cook for everyone, the vulgar, exurban mansion was as serene as a Japanese temple. In many of the houses, the huge attached garage had the only exposure to the sun and view of the mountains, and in those cases, we made the garage the main living room. Our water and our electric ovens were heated by the sun's power. After dark, we use lamps fueled by olive oil, and the nighttime hours were restored to their quiet mystery. That's a little something from a book I wrote a decade ago called Dignity. No endorsement of Amazon, but you can get it there. And circumstances dictate that I have to remind you all that we have a Patreon Desert Oracle. We're going to make sure you have a show every week, and we're going to try to do more in these weird times. Good night from the voice of the desert.
It's the bottom of the hour, and you are listening to Desert Oracle Radio Replay on KGVM Bozeman Community Radio at 95.9 FM. Ken produced this next episode on March 17th, 2022. This offering is called Druid Stories to Ward Off St. Patrick.
Transmitting from the Mojave Wilderness in Joshua Tree, California, now is the time for Desert Oracle Radio, the voice of the desert.
Night has fallen on the desert. No matter where you are in the wild world, people are celebrating the evangelist saint of ancient Ireland. He called himself Patricios. Patricios, patrician, patriarch, father of his people, enlisted father. That last one's the old Latin definition. Originally to describe members of the Roman Senate. Patrick's achievement was, so we are told, the peaceful conversion of the polytheistic, nature-loving, and supernaturally gifted people of Ireland to Roman Christianity. It's something we celebrate today by dumping food coloring in the Chicago River. And the grocery stores pile up the Guinness by the checkout lines. And a lot of people who rarely take a drink go out and do it poorly. Patrick was maybe the first and last person to bring anything peacefully to Ireland. Maybe that's why the wild Irish of the late 4th and early 5th century let it happen. Somebody was always raiding and colonizing Ireland. The Vikings, Oliver Cromwell, scammy dot-com companies 15 or 20 years ago, etc. Patrick had to convince the warlords and the kings, and especially the wealthy women who supported his ministry, that his magic could match the magic of the Druids. The Druids, for their part, are said to have prophesied Patrick's mission and its killing effect on the old sacred society of Ireland, in which the Druids held the roles of priest and judge, magician and mystic. Across the sea will come Ad's head, crazed in the head, his cloak with a hole for the head, his stick bent in the head. He will chant impieties from a table in the front of his house. All his people will answer, so be it, so be it. Ad said, because Patrick had that circle of hair scalped off his head. Scissor head, pretty much, is the translation. The Druid sure knew how to mock a missionary. Everything from his Roman robes to his pastoral staff, a symbol of the bishops. His followers would become the mindless amen crowd, but because he was crazed in the head, he would overturn the religious and social order. But only with the help of an earlier Patrick, Palladios or Palladius. We don't hear much about Palladios, the bishop from Gaul who was working in Ireland first, because most of his deeds and personal history were conflated with the later career of Patrick. Nothing is ever as it seems. Nothing, including the supposed peaceful mission of Patrick. Because his real title, according to 7th century Irish biographers, was Magnus Suscitus. Apparently Latinized from Old Proto-Celtic, but now figured to mean something like Apollo the War King. And it is said that he ruled 4 great houses of Druids. So tonight, in tribute to the druids who were replaced by black-clad priests and empty theologies, I want to tell you some stories. Ghost stories, you could call them. From those ancient Celtic lands that gave us the she, the good people, the gentry, the leprechauns and the banshee, the goddess Brigid and the frightful Pooka, the dim kingdom. The dim kingdom and the Tua de Danum. This tale, told by Michael H. late in the 19th century, comes from William Butler Yeats' essential collection of Irish mysticism and folklore, The Celtic Twilight. Many a poor man, from Finn McCool to our own days, has had some such adventure to tell of, writes Yeats. For those creatures, the good people, love to repeat themselves. At any rate, the storytellers do. In the times when we used to travel by the canal, said Michael H., I was coming down from Dublin. When we came to Mullingar, the canal ended, and I began to walk. And stiff and fatigued I was after the slowness. I had some friends with me, and now and then we walked, and now and then we rode in a cart. And so on, till we saw some girls milking cows, and stopped to joke with them. And after a while, we asked them for a drink of milk. We have nothing to put it in here, they said. But come to the house with us. We went home with them and sat round the fire talking. After a while, the others went and left me, loath to stir from the good fire. I asked the girls for something to eat. There was a pot on the fire, and they took the meat out and put it on a plate and told me to only eat the meat that came off the head. When I had eaten, the girls went out, and I did not see them again. It grew darker and darker, and there I still sat, loath as ever to leave the good fire. And after a while, two men came in, carrying between them a corpse. When I saw them coming, I hid behind the door, says one to the other, putting the corpse on the spit. Hold during the spit, says the other. Michael H., come out of that and turn the meat. I came out all of a tremble and began turning the spit. Michael H., says the one who spoke first, if you let it burn, we'll have to put you on the spit instead. And on that they went out. I sat there trembling and turning the corpse till towards midnight. The men came again, and the one said it was burnt, and the other said it was done right. But having fallen out over it, they both said they would do me no harm that time. And, sitting by the fire, one of them cried out, Michael H., can you tell me a story? Divil a one, said I, on which he caught me by the shoulder and put me out like a shot. It was a wild, blowing night. Never in all my born days did I see such a night. The darkest night that ever came out of the heavens. I did not know where I was for the life of me. So when one of the men came after me and touched me on the shoulder with a, Michael H., can you tell a story now? I can, says I. And he brought me, and putting me by the fire, says, begin. I have no story but the one, says I. that I was sitting here and you two men brought in a corpse and put it on the spit and set me turning it. That'll do, says he. You may go in there and lie down on the bed. And I went, nothing loath. And in the morning, where was I but in the middle of a green field? The good people we should recognize are far more than the impish and solitary leprechaun occasionally witnessed on an overgrown path, beckoning to the curious. They are beautiful women, too, and frightening men carrying a human corpse and threatening murder. Where there is nothing but a green field, they can make a house lit up on a dark night and unaccountable orbs of light flying in strange formation over the countryside. They appear in military uniform and seemingly overwhelming strength in numbers. And in a blink of an eye, it's all gone. More than a century ago, fresh from San Diego and a degree at Stanford and seeking a degree from Jesus College at Oxford, the young American scholar Walter Evans Wentz traveled the back roads and villages of six Celtic lands, collecting the personal experiences of real people, such as a man who lived his whole life in County Sligo beneath Ben Bulbin. And he described his many encounters with the gentry. The folk are the grandest I have ever seen. They are far superior to us, and that is why they are called the gentry. They are a military aristocratic class, tall and noble appearing. They are a distinct race between our own and that of the spirits, as they have told me. Their qualifications are tremendous. We could cut off half the human race, but would not, they said. For we are expecting salvation. And I knew a man 3 or 4 years ago whom they struck down with paralysis. Their sight is so penetrating that I think they could see through the earth. They have a silvery voice, quick and sweet. The music they play is the most beautiful. They take the whole body and soul of young and intellectual people who are interesting, transmuting the body to a body like their own. I asked them once if they ever died, and they said, "No, we are always kept young." Once they take you and you taste food in their palace, you cannot come back. You are changed to one of them and live with them forever. They are able to appear in different forms. One once appeared to me and seemed only 4 feet high and stoutly built. He said, "I am bigger than I appear to you now. We can make the old young, the big small, the small big." One of their women told all the secrets of my family. She said that my brother in Australia would travel much and suffer hardships, all of which came true, and foretold that my nephew, then about 2 years old, would become a great clergyman in America, and that is what he is now. Besides the gentry, who are a distinct class, there are bad spirits and ghosts, which are nothing like them. My mother once saw a leprechaun beside a bush, hammering. He disappeared before she could get to him. But he also was unlike one of the gentry. Everywhere the Irish went, they brought their fairy faith, their folklore, their customs. So that in the gold rush a century and a half ago now, when hundreds of thousands of Irish arrived in California, the Celtic beliefs quickly merged with the Indian and Spanish lore of the West. And the Irish, who had a bad time of it for much of the 800 years between the Norman lords and the Great Famine, suddenly found themselves in a new position. An Irish miner, it turned out, had better than average luck finding gold.
And so began the phrase, the luck of the Irish. Because they were scorned in the towns and the cities and the mining camps due to their poverty and cultural differences, and especially their Catholicism, the phrase luck of the Irish became popular throughout California and Nevada, and eventually the whole English-speaking world. It was something of an insult. A newly arrived Irish miner could not have hit the mother lode through skill and smarts and hard work. It had to be dumb luck and nothing more. And yet the most successful mine operators continued to be of Irish or Scots-Irish ancestry. George Hearst, for example. As in the prospector and investor who picked the biggest winners of them all, the Comstock Lode in the Virginia Mountains of northern Nevada, the Anaconda Mine in Montana, the Ontario Mine in Park City, Utah. His luck, if you can boil down a lifetime of making the right decisions to luck, was such that he acquired the San Francisco Examiner because the previous owner owed Hearst a significant gambling debt. So the legend goes, anyway. And so began the golden literary age of California. Mark Twain, Ambrose Bierce, Jack London. Along with the worst tendencies of muckraking newspaper journalism, which developed more or less concurrently around the English-speaking world from Fleet Street to the New York World, a two-penny paper filled with wild headlines and incredible stories that influenced William Randolph Hearst especially. But the Irish were not the only Celts in Sierra Nevada. Cornwall, a land famed for its miners and mineral wealth going back to the Phoenician sea trade, gave their own culture and supernatural lore to the silver and gold mines deep beneath the earth's surface. Pixies, or piskies, arrived with the Cornish in the form of knockers, or tommyknockers. These capricious sprites of the mine tunnels could be helpful or not, depending on how you treated them. Leaving offerings of food or libation was a way to keep them on your good side. And their telltale knocking led many a miner to a deep, rich vein of ore. But sometimes the rapid knocking was an alarm to get everyone to the surface because a mine shaft was about to collapse. A lot of Cornish miners arrived in the Sierra with family relations already established. And Cornish Jack became a nickname for Californians from Cornwall because somebody always had a cousin Jack or a cousin Jenny that they could send for, usually a skilled hard rock and water pressure miner from the old Celtic country. Thousands of their descendants still live in the towns and foothills of the Sierra today. Some describe the knockers as spirits making sounds, something like the poltergeist of Germany. But the variations in experience is what keeps the supernatural world always at a distance from our workaday world. Here's a description of the Cornish knockers from a newspaper called the Daily Mining Gazette. Knockers were about 2 feet tall and were quite grizzled. They dressed in mining clothes, which included a tull, an old-style mining hat made of thick felt. Very mischievous in nature, knockers were usually responsible for stealing tools left carelessly about, and for taking food. Who the knockers are is still debated in Cornwall. Some say they are the ghost of people not bad enough to go to hell, but were not worthy of heaven. Others assert that they are the pre-Christian gods who were sprinkled with holy water, which caused them to shrink. Still others say that they are the spirits of virtuous pagans. Let us now hear from John Boylan, who lived near the ancient seat of the Irish High Kings at the Hill of Tara. There are said to be a whole tribe of little red men living in Glen Otter, between Ringlestown and Tara. And on long evenings in June, they have been heard. They have been seen serenading round the western slope of Tara, dressed in ancient Irish costumes. And unlike the little red men, these fairy races are warlike and given to making invasions. Long processions of them have been seen going round the king's chair, an earthwork on which the kings of Tara are said to have been crowned. And then they would appear like soldiers of ancient Ireland in review. Let's finally tell of the fairy creatures. The shadowy things we might describe today as big black cats or the stinking red-eyed monsters of the wilderness. Or any number of fanciful apparitions that will never be captured, living or dead. For they move easily within and without our materialist reality. In the course of another conversation, Stephen, a piper of Galway, pointed to a rocky knoll in a field not far from his home and said, "I saw a dog with a white ring around his neck by that hill there. And the oldest men round Galway have seen him too, for he has been here for 100 years or more. He is a dog of the good people and only appears at certain hours of the night." That one you'll find in Evan Wentz's The Fairy Faith in Celtic Countries. And we have time, I think, for a last contribution from Yeats. A few years ago, a friend of mine told me of something that happened to him when he was a young man and out drilling. They were but a carful and drove along a hillside until they came to a quiet place. They left the car and went further up the hill with their rifles and drilled for a while. As they were coming down again, they saw a very thin, long-legged pig of the old Irish sort, and the pig began to follow them. One of them cried out, as a joke, that it was a fairy pig. And they all began to run to keep up with the joke. The pig ran too, and presently, how nobody knew, this mock terror became real terror. And they ran as for their lives. When they got to the car, they made the horse gallop as fast as possible. But the pig still followed. Then one of them put up his rifle to fire, but when he looked along the barrel, he could see nothing. Presently, they turned a corner and came to a village. They told the people of the village what had happened, and the people of the village took pitchforks and spades and the like, and went along the road with them to drive the pig away. But when they turned the corner, they could not find anything. The fairy pig had disappeared.
I'm a poor man. And I wants money the worst way. And I'll tell you the truth, if you give me £1,000 tomorrow morning, I wouldn't dig a spit with a spade in it.
Well, what about the fairy field now, where they've changed it to?
The fairy field and the Raheen is all the same to me. I wouldn't meddle with it. And God between us and all harm, I don't want to see anyone around here meddling with it. With that enchanted place.
From Amboy to Isaacs, and across the great Mojave Wilderness, this is Desert Oracle Radio, and I am your host, Ken Lane. The moody music heard throughout our broadcast, those are the soundscapes composed and performed by the High Desert Zone Red, Blue, Black, Silver. And I believe starting off tonight with some help from S.W. Lawden on the drums. Well, it's springtime, and I am happy to be getting on the desert road, which is the best feeling in the world. I'm headed to Utah, Green River, Moab. I will be broadcasting the show from KZMU-FM two Saturdays from now, I believe. And I need to stop in Las Vegas on the way back and sign some books at the Writer's Block in the Arts District downtown. And I probably need to drive to all the independent bookstores in Nevada, the Eastern Sierra, the Sierra Nevada. Just those two words, Sierra and Nevada, in various configurations forever. You can find us online at desertoracle.com, where you can find back issues of our occasional journal, also called Desert Oracle. And support this show however you like. We do appreciate it. Our Desert Oracle Volume 1 paperback is available at bookstores everywhere, especially the American Southwest. And thanks for putting us again on the LA Times bestsellers list for yet another week. Well, I'm gonna close down the radio studio and maybe head on down to O'Malley's Bar for a glass and a pint. Why not? Enjoy your weekend, in moderation, of course. A good night from the voice of the desert.
Well, the snow at my house is still between, somewhere between 2.5 and 3 feet in depth. And so as it melts back, the tracks in it are starting to be more apparent. That's always my favorite part of the snow melting, is watching the little critter tracks. Well, spring equinox is March 20th. World Water Day is March 22nd. And those are two events worth celebrating this week, so I hope you can celebrate them well. My thanks to Ken Lane and Red, Blue, Black, Silver for sharing their work on Desert Oracle Radio. Thanks to everyone that volunteers and supports KGBM, and thank you for listening. If you want to reach me, the number is 406-404-6246. You leave me a message there and I will get back to you. You can hear this program live on the air at 95.9 FM, Bozeman Community Radio, or you can stream it online at kgvm.org at 7 Sunday nights and 9 Monday mornings. Our past Desert Oracle Radio replay episodes are also available on demand on the kgvm.org website. At the time of this recording, there is not a recent Desert Oracle Radio episode, but I expect one any day now, and I will have that for you March 23rd if it appears. Either way, I'll be back next week with more desert and mountain lore for you. Till then, keep doing good things, stay well, and sweet dreams, and enjoy the melt. See you then.